Mr. Martin Tanner, baritone of Dayton, Ohio, made his town hall debut last night. He came well prepared, but unfortunately his presentation was not up to contemporary professional standards. His voice lacks the range of tonal color necessary to make it consistently interesting. Full-time consideration of another endeavor might be in order. He came home to Dayton and was questioned by his friends, but he smiled and just said nothing, and he never sang again. Excepting very late at night when the shop was dark and closed. He sang softly to himself as he sorted through the clothes. But music was his life. It was not his livelihood, and it made him feel so happy, and it made him feel so good, and he sang from his heart, and he sang from his soul. He did not know how well he sang. It just made him.
Which ultimately translates as "Don't take the words of the critics to heart." He did not know how well he sang. It just made him whole. Heartrending. Almost as heartrending as a newcomer to the University of Lincoln's Communications and Public Relations course starting in September, but she was such a wow when she actually impressed us with her radio work at an open day a few months ago. We said, Kira Osbrook, would you like to actually join us on a semi-regular basis to kind of talk us through various things until you actually arrive like a phoenix burning through from Derbyshire right the way through to the joys of the University of Lincoln, where you probably take part actually with Ben in social media and work for the wonderful Lincoln Book Festival. Kira Osbrook, welcome to the programme. How are you?
Hi, I'm really well, thank you. How are you?
Very good indeed. Now, it's fair to say, Kira, that since we last spoke and we talked about your dog, whose name, of course, is...
Zippy.
That Zippy, as in named after the rainbow character, I believe. Or is it just Zippy because he's quick? I don't know. It's be one of those.
I think it's both, really. It's just Ditsy, so it blends in quite well.
Ditsy Zippy. Fantastic. But you are about to go, if you haven't already gone, totally viral, national, etc., because, well, just share with us what exciting things you've been up to with respect to radio, the Childline campaign, and so on. Take it away, Kira.
There's loads to tell, really. Well, basically, part of college, we do like a final major project, basically, to wrap up our entire course. Everyone's got to do it, and obviously, because we're part of Nottingham, the 40 years of volunteering in Nottingham, was coming to Nottingham, and it wasn't just about the city, it was also based on a national scale as well. So obviously they worked with us and everybody did some photography, some documentary making, some interviews and some podcasts. So obviously I was head of the interviews and I went out to go and speak to some of these volunteers from Childline. And they all had really, it was quite emotional really. And it was, you know, you didn't know how to take some of the stories because some of them were really overwhelming and happy and others were really quite more like a cry for help for the people, for the children. But anyway, I interviewed this, there was this blind man and he'd been volunteering for 20 years or so and he'd been on ITV this morning, you know, trying to campaign and things like that. So obviously he helped his campaign too. And anyway, when it came to editing my podcast for the interviews, I asked to do like a compilation and it was basically three or four different voices with an emotional track embedded underneath. Sounds really weird, but it sounds really good. And obviously that got noticed at this awards evening. And then a lady called Claire Perry, who is the Childline Volunteer Coordinator, basically asked me if I wanted to do a radio advert for Childline, which would be obviously broadcasted across their actual whole website online network. I think it'd probably be across social media as well. And it will be obviously recorded within the summer, and it will be just campaigning about how to volunteer to get on board and to help children, basically. So it was amazing. It was an amazing opportunity to do. So I'm just planning for it.
I think Kira deserves a round of applause for that. You know, that's initiative, showing the staff way. And Ben, let's face it, in your capacity as a returning guru to Signet PR, doesn't Kira Allsbrook show, is she not showing the right stuff?
No, it's great. It's great to see a lot of passion there. It's something that will certainly benefit you when you come to university and obviously after university as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's a great initiative to be doing, especially, you know, on your way into university. It's perfect, really.
And you see, Kira, although you've never actually spoken directly to Ben before, because he's returned from a year's placement in Crewe, where he's working for Bentley. Listen to the early part of the programme on podcast.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. But he came to us actually through the RAF, I believe. You went to see the RAF at an air show somewhere, and people said you should go and do public relations at Lincoln.
Basically, yeah. That was the PR manager of the Red Arrows, and then did some work experience with those guys and came and discovered Lincoln whilst I was visiting up here. And
in so many ways, actually, coming up from Brighton is almost as traumatic as travelling over from Derbyshire, I feel, because it's like such a culture shift. You know, it's a culture shift in so many ways. You know, Derbyshire, Lincoln. I mean, I do believe Phil Hamlin wonders, are you not a Derby County fan, if memory
serves?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, God. Sorry, but there's some rivalry there.
No.
What pray tell side do you actually follow then, Kira, if it's not Derby County?
Nottingham Forest.
Yeah.
Well, there is a connection, and it all actually connects with that wonderful centre of the arts in Lincoln, the Drill Hall, where we had that wonderful play about Brian Clough.
Of course.
And his short stay at Leeds United. Mm. I watched it absolutely in raptures as they reminded me of the time when Derby County won the first division. And I remember exactly where I was, exactly what I was doing.
That was 1972, if memory serves.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, I was in Kent. I was doing the audit of an airline, a small airline based at Manston Airport.
And suddenly, when you were hoping against hope that Don Revie's men would have done it for Leeds, suddenly you found it was Clough for you.
And it was Cloughy in Derby County, and yeah. I was the happiest I've been for a long time.
It connects Brighton as well.
Of course.
He's Brighton manager as well, for just over a year.
Slightly longer than Leeds. Peter Taylor stayed there longer, I believe.
Yeah.
So it all works together.
Yeah, great man.
And obviously, no Brian Clough and Peter Taylor. Clearly, Kira, no European championships 2 years running, or two European Cups 2 years running, and, of course, winning the league. So it's all good from Nottingham Forest's point of view.
That is.
Marvellous. Although the likelihood of Kira ever becoming public relations officer for Derby County, I would suspect remote.
No.
He says that now. Ben, have you got any advice for Kira? I mean, just cast your mind back, what, 2 years now, 3 years, when you were sort of just thinking about, oh yes, I'm months away from actually coming to Lincoln to study the full-time public relations program, saying that Kira's doing communications and public relations. What advice would you give her at this time of year, where, you know, she's just going to be the voice of Childline? What she should be expecting, and why should Signet PR be a number one thing she should be connecting with?
Yeah, I'd certainly recommend perhaps looking into industries that you're kind of interested in. For example, I mean, with PR, the great thing is that you can transfer into all kinds of industries. But I think it'd be a good idea to look at any particular industries that might take your fancy, perhaps charity work or anything to do with Childline, or even anything else that you have in mind. And I'd certainly say look at perhaps doing some research into that. Maybe add an account on LinkedIn or something, and look at perhaps the people in that industry, get to know faces, and maybe even get to find out, perhaps if you have any more extra time there over summer, try and organise, you know, a short spell of work experience to see if that industry is right for you, you know. And I'd certainly say just get to know what the field's like, what's out there for you, and certainly perhaps as well in Lincoln, if there's anything that whilst you're at university you can get hands on with when you're over here.
I think she's already signed up for the Midrick Drive. I
mean, yeah, oh, obligatory. It's obligatory.
I think, yeah, very essential.
Couldn't say no.
Shaylee, anything to add?
In terms of advice for coming to uni?
I mean, obviously you're an English graduate, so clearly it's a different area entirely. Really. But same school.
Definitely. I would say don't pick English.
It's all right.
Which is good because you're not. And also enjoy your first year because that's the year that doesn't count.
Well,
so long as you get 40%. If you get 40%, you go on that second
year. You see, sometimes these English undergraduates, Phil, I don't know where they go with the rest of their ocean.
And also, after uni, don't give up because you will get that job.
It'll all happen wonderfully. And you're nodding, Phil, to confirm that, presumably.
I think two things. From what I've gathered of you guys here, it is a course you can really get stuck into if you want. And actually want to do it, go for it. There's plenty to do. But then if you're determined, you will get a job and the job you want.
Okay. So there we are. That's been the Midweek Drive's inspirational line just for yourself, Kira Allsbrook, which is always great to do. It's always important. Ben, last two questions, please, for Kira. Thank you.
Kira, have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today on the show?
Yes, I have. Thank
Excellent.
You.
Excellent. And, well, I know you'll be returning in September, but would you like to return before then for a little catch-up, perhaps?
No, absolutely not. No, obviously, yes, I'd love to.
Excellent.
Just for a moment, she's teasing. Do you know, she's just for a moment now, thinking she's going down the line of Eleanor Tomlinson, thinking...
That's
the best answer
we've ever had, Kira.
There you go. Surely we all need heroes. We have to have heroes. Otherwise, the world would be just a little bit darker if we couldn't actually turn around and say, what would John Jarrold, our script doctor, say if we called him for help on this one? John Jarrold, what would you say? Do we need heroes?
We always need heroes and heroines.
Of course. Thank you for that. Thank you for reminding me it's very important to make sure that there's a good balance there. Shaylee is nodding.
Please include the women. Don't leave the women out.
Quite rightly so. Shailene McKenzie with us. We've said farewell and adieu for the moment to Phil Hamlin-Williams, who's headed off back to the Drill Hall and doing various other things. Remember, the flash fiction competition for the Lincoln Literary Festival is up and running until July the 6th. You've got, in fact, John, as there's no upper age limit, you would be into category 3. If you want to put together 50 words, you could possibly enter yourself, although maybe the professionalism might give it away, possibly.
I would never say that. It's very different from being a literary agent.
Well, I mean, have you ever been a judge in a flash fiction competition? Because they seem to be becoming very, very popular these days.
No, I was a judge in a fiction competition at a science fiction convention about 10 years ago, where we had the first chapter to deal with, but never flash fiction.
Well, it may well be that we might invite you for Telefantasy and Society 3, which is scheduled for latter part of 2019, to actually work that, because, of course, we'll be celebrating 60 years of the Twilight Zone,
yep.
50 years of the Apollo moon landings,
and
exactly lots of other exciting things as well. So we'll just gradually begin to talk about things that might be happening with respect to that. So we'll progress onwards. Ben Lewis is also in the studio with us. Ben, you impressed with John's website?
Yeah, I'm just having a look at your website, John. It's eye-catching, it's relatable, it's very well laid out. I do like it.
Well, it's very kind of you, Ben. Thank you. I try to make it as straightforward as possible, because I know some people find it difficult to navigate through professional publishers and agents' websites. And I just want people to realise, come and talk to me. That's what I'm there for.
So nothing beats simplicity.
Yep.
Keep it simple, the maxim of the world from that perspective. The Arthur C. Clarke Awards, Shaley, are you familiar with them?
I am indeed.
I've only read one of them so far, which is Anne Charnock's Dreams Before the Start of Time.
Margaret Atwood's A Handmaid's Tale?
Oh, yeah, but I'm talking about this year.
I haven't read anything this year.
The shortlist for this year, as follows: the aforementioned Dreams Before the Start of Time, Anne Charnock, which I don't think it'll win, I'll be honest, John, but I think it's got an outside chance. Spaceman of Bohemia by Yaroslav Kalfa, which, again, according to Sci-Fi SFX magazine, is not really going to do too many things. It could be famous last words. The Guardian described this as Solaris with laughs.
Yes. I think you've got because it's written by a Czech author, you've got that wonderful history of Czech surrealism and comedy going back to Kafka.
So you've got a sort of metamorphosis, a trial, and all sorts of other fits and pieces from that point of view. Czech emigre Kalfa, I see what they did there, Kalfa, Kafka, may have left the United States when he was 15, but the subversive, absurdist spirit of Milan Kundera and the Prague Spring runs through his novel. It tells the tale of the first Czech man in space. Sea of Rust, Ben. C. Robert Cargill is the writer for this. The sea in question is a wasteland in a post-apocalyptic future. Have we seen this before, Shaley?
Blade Runner.
Future, yeah. Well, apparently not, because Cargill's elegant twist is to craft a post-human Western featuring renegade robots as a way to explore questions around collectivism versus individualization.
Westworld, question mark?
You see, John, where, you know, Shaley was on the judging panel, original...
I mean, yeah, the idea is interesting, because you never know where somebody's going to go with that, but...
It's always about what you do and how you do it, so that, you know, you might get three wonderful authors telling you the same story with the same characters, and one of them will make you go, wow, because of the way they
did it.
Maybe... Omar El Akkad with American War could actually do that. His line for American War is 2074, and United States law has banned using fossil fuels. A second civil war ensues, and the impressive debut from Egyptian-Canadian journalist El Akkad uses this what-if moment as a jumping-off point to chart the making of a terrorist.
That sounds interesting.
American War.
And he's been compared to Cormac McCarthy's The Road and Philip Roth's Plot Against America. And it's interesting that four of these six books are published by literary imprints, not by science fiction and fantasy imprints.
Now, that's a big line, of course, given the Margaret Atwood line, who never really wanted to be associated with the version of science fiction, of course. We were speaking in the first part of the programme, John, of course, about another writer, Michael Moore Pergo, who detests being referred to as a children's author.
Yeah, yeah. Although I think he's been the children's laureate.
How interesting. So maybe we should go along to the Lincoln Book Festival and discuss that with him.
Or just a writer who's... primary audience is children. Well, this is for everyone.
He's a wonderful writer.
Wide demographic.
Anybody should read Michael's books.
Jeff Vandermeer with Bourne. The line for this, a ruined city and a giant grizzly from which a biotech scavenger retrieves a sea anemone. I always have trouble with anemone. But there we are. It's an anemone-shaped creature, lush, wildly imaginative, and shot through with ideas that most writers simply wouldn't have the nerve to pursue. Big Beard Vandermeer's prose calls to mind Mervyn Peake for its sheer fearlessness, according to SFX.
He is an amazing writer, one of the great surrealists of the last 20 years. And again, it's interesting that having been published on a science fiction imprint once, he's now in Fourth Estate, which is HarperCollins Literary imprint.
You see, John knows his book publishers. He's on the finger of the pulse there. And finally, for the completion of the shortlist for the 2018 Arthur C. Clarke Award, we have Gather the Daughters by Jenny McLeod. Or McLeod? McLeod.
Malamud?
Even Malamud, thank you. Lord above, sometimes if you don't have people correcting, like, you're
I don't have
right.
my glasses on, but
exactly.
I'm pretty sure that doesn't have a C in it.
You're quite right. It is Jenny Malamud, American writer who's also a psychiatric nurse practitioner who works with traumatised children. It's this experience that seems to inform her debut novel, set in a misogynist dystopia. Critics inevitably make comparisons with...
A Handmaid's Tale.
Exactly. But this is vivid, serious and disquieting in its own right. The prediction for SFX, an apposite choice in the hashtag MeToo era.
I feel, yeah. I mean, this is just my perspective, but I feel like there's only so much people can take of this.
Really?
Seriously? So.
Hashtag. Yeah. Gift that keeps on giving. Ben?
I don't really know what to add, to be honest.
Well, of course, the thing with a juried award is you'll never know, because there are some times with a juried award where some of the jury loves one book and some of the jury loves another book, and neither of them will vote for the other one of those two, and you end up with a third book coming through because they're all willing to vote for that. But that doesn't always happen. And I think the great variation with the Clarke Award is you can't tell what's going to win.
And there we have it. So, Sea of Rust, Dreams Before the Start of Time, American War, Spaceman of Bohemia, Gather the Daughters, and Bourne. I'm going to take a punt here and suggest it could well be Sea of Rust for me. I just have a sense it could well be Sea of Rust or American War. I'd like it to be Anne Charnock, because I've read it. I feel like kind of bond with the whole thing. I think that may be a little bit too thoughtful, and I'm not sure whether, as we've said, Gather the Daughters will necessarily sort of work through that. But, John, any thoughts from yourself, or is it a case of, no, I couldn't possibly comment?
I think you've got six great books there. I think, like every year, there are books that, as an individual, subjectively, you'll say, I can't believe that's not on the shortlist. But that's the situation. It is a subjective shortlist. You've got the various jurists who've read over 100 titles and have made this decision between them. So I can think, going back to the early 90s, late 80s, almost every year there will be something that I think, well, that should have been on the shortlist. But it's not always going to happen. So I think all six of these books are very good. I have personal favourite, but no, I'm not going to say that.
That's fine. Ben, any of those grab from the descriptors you say, yeah, when I'm next taking the train down to Brighton, I might sort of load that up on my Kindle or indeed, you know, go for a hard copy.
Well, I think the most interesting one is the American War one. Mm. Now, I don't know, but hearing that, I was a bit in two minds about it, because part of me was questioning or sort of being very sceptical of it. Mm. But I'm intrigued to see what the outcome of it would be.
The very fact it's Egyptian-Canadian could have issues there, you know.
Well, I can't take that for face value. I mean, I think you have to judge it in the writing, don't you, really? But
well said, Ben. Well
yeah,
said.
It was true, though, isn't it?
I do not think any of the jurists will give a toss about what's happening with America and Canada. Mm-hmm. They'll purely and simply say, this is the book we love. Because, yes. It's, apart from anything else, it's a British jury. So why would they care?
Rightly so.
And it does seem to have, dare I say it, almost eclipsed the Hugo Awards in terms of general range of stock. I mean, the Arthur C. Clarke Award, which will kind of follow through over, well, really, the duration of the Sci-Fi London Film Festival, has really kind of just been increasing every year in terms of quality. I mean, one thing I will say this year, for me, John, I don't think we've had a standout Adrian Tchaikovsky type.
I mean, I think, for instance, Kim Stanley Robinson's New York 2140.
Yeah.
Is a wonderful science fiction novel. And I would certainly not have had a problem with that being on the shortlist. Mm. But as I say, that's a subjective opinion. That's not objective.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely.
And yeah, I mean, if you look back at the last 5, 6, 7 years, I mean, I will put my hand up here and just say that my client, Chris Beckett, won it in 2013 for Dark Eden, which is a
he owes it all to you, John. Let's face it, he owes it all to you.
But basically, you've got a wonderful mixture of winners over the last decade and much longer as well. Mm. So, with the Clark, obviously, you're looking at it as science fiction's equivalent of the Booker Prize, whereas the Hugo is very much a popularity award. So sometimes you'll get the same author winning the Hugo 3 years running because that's their time to be really, really popular. It's happened with a number of authors over the years. You've also, of course, had great Hugo winners like Dune, like The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin. So it's not all one thing. It's never wonderful. It's never awful. It's there. And the Clark Award, like the Nebula in America, is juried. So it has that sense of what works for, if you like, a more literary side of the genre.
Now, the good news, hopefully, technology being what it is and not in a science fiction fantasy world, is we've just been joined by our ace American director from Los Angeles. That would be a wonderful Phil Lernes. Phil, are you indeed there and connected with us?
I am here. I am hoping you can hear me, and I call you from that futuristic, misogynistic dystopia that we call Hollywood.
Whoa, there we are. It's all interconnecting magically. So any thoughts on, from the descriptors of,
yes.
the book? Yeah, go for it.
Yes.
Then. John, are you happy to stick
yes.
with this to find the views of Phil Lernes? Go, yes.
Okay, all right. The Solaris with laughs. I mean, you had me at Solaris with laughs. In fact, I would love to start recording and we could do, like, I'll read segments of that book as my spot each and every week. That's what I want to do. But speaking as an American and representative of this country, I would like to speak directly to the Clark jury and say, please vote for Canada. Do as most Americans will do. Vote Canadian.
I heartily endorse that.
There you are. The message has gone out there. You know, and just when we were saying, Ben, when we were having a brief interlude earlier today, a sort of pre-show discussion meeting, I said, you know, whatever. Surely Donald Trump's got something right with respect to Kim Jong-un. You know, and you said, I said, should we ask Phil Lernes what he thinks about the tremendous success and now the best pals and bosom buddies, etc. I know Richard Fitzwilliams tomorrow is going to talk about that photograph and all sorts of other bits and pieces, but the body language is good, if nothing else.
Yeah, that was something.
Well, we can talk about this on my time. I do, of course, have many thoughts, but I don't want to take the conversation away from reading. I mean, if anything, in Trump America, we need more conversations about books, more conversations about reading. But I am curious about what was brought up, if I may, about Flash fiction. Is this the equivalent of like a 24-hour film challenge that you were referencing?
Even more concentrated in many ways. 50 words. And not
no more and no less. No, has to be 50 words.
Has to be 50 words. Lincoln.ac.uk/...
Competitions,
and you'll find all details about the Lincoln Flash fiction. I'm sure you could put in an entry, Phil, actually, if you wish to put that 50 words. Exactly.
Do they have Waterstones in America?
Do we have what in America?
It's not a sacred Celtic term, basically. John, yes. Have Waterstones actually gone all the way to America?
No.
There we are. So he'd have to come over here.
It's a book-selling chain.
Oh, yes. Okay, I've been into that. But you're right. Waterstones did sound like something like an ancient rune of some kind. Yes, probably. I mean, and in which case, if it was an ancient Celtic rune, I'm sure that we do have it and it's buried somewhere under like the Washington Monument or something. It's one of the things the Masons brought over. But no, the bookstore chain we don't have. That's right.
As a filmmaker, Phil, and I'll bring yourself and John in on this, if I may, etc. We'll turn to you first, John. Clearly, the holy grail in so many ways of the partnership between writer, author, agent, and so on is the multimedia, multi-platform, transmedia storytelling tale that actually works through that. How much of your time is actually spent actually sorting out the legal realities of that, looking for the best deal, etc., waiting to get books optioned, and so on and so forth?
More than it used to be, and there is one reason for that, which is George R.R. Martin. The fact that that series has worked so well on TV has made a huge shift in that if Lord of the Rings was being made today, and of course it is going to be remade, it would be made for TV. It would not be three-hour movies. And because you've got Netflix, HBO, and other companies interested in that, and Apple are now getting interested in it as well, there's a call for more material to be used. So I have a film agent in Los Angeles who deals with all my clients. She and I speak probably 3-4 times a week now, whereas we used to speak probably once a week about various clients, who they should be shown to. However, I will say, 1 in 100 shows of interest leads to an option. 1 in 100 options leads to a film or TV series. So it's very much not what you're looking for the day you publish. It happens occasionally, but it only happens occasionally. Don't base your life on the exception to the rule.
Does that chime with your experience, Phil Lynn? Is it a case of, I just go with where the muse takes me in terms of what we're looking for?
Well, there are so many aspects to this question. I mean, the amount of legal time that's spent, having just finished creating all the deliverable items for my new movie, which I delivered to the distributor yesterday, an inordinate amount of time, it felt, was spent on legal protections. I mean, everything we needed, we thought, to be in place, we already had. But just the chain of title work alone, which is specific to this conversation, it's almost overwhelming how much protection everybody wants. But I remind that there are cases that prove the point, especially for these big corporations. The funniest one to me is still the big screen Dukes of Hazzard movie. With Johnny Knoxville, where, not a good movie, but the movie made a decent amount at the box office, something along the lines, at least in America, of $60 million on a $20 million budget. You think, okay, great, that's a decent profit. And they, of course, had purchased the rights to the TV series on which it was based. What they did not do, and which came as a shock to everyone, was they did not purchase the rights to the underlying source material for the TV show, which was a book. And it was a shock to everyone that they did not do that, because we all wondered, how the heck was Dukes of Hazzard based on a book to begin with? Who wrote that book? And the author, quite wisely, never piped up until the movie came out. And then it was too late for the studio to do anything about it, and all the box office money ended up going to the author.
Yeah, exactly. It is why there's a second version of the James Bond movie Thunderball as Never Say Never Again, because
right.
It was Kevin McClory who owned the rights to that particular story.
So, but it is interesting, this issue also of time is really an interesting one, because I can see from, the publisher's point of view, time operating in a certain way that, as you were saying, it's so rare for these books to be optioned, to be made, and then even when they are made, for them to make any money and all of this. And it's such a lengthy time that you can't chase that. The inverse is true in filmmaking, I found, which is I have to be so careful and diligent about taking notes and keeping notes of everything that I've read. Because I never want years from now to say, oh, boy, these people saying that I stole this may have a point, because, yes, I read that 20 years ago. And we are at the point where you're responsible for all of that. And, the creative process being what it is, you never know when inspiration is going to hit and you're going to make connections between things.
Even in publishing terms. Alter Carbon, which has just been a hit for, I think, Netflix. Now, that was published in 2002. The film rights were sold for £1 million around the time it was published, but it's still taken 16 years for that to actually be produced. So even if you do that deal day one, it's not always going to be a fast move through to production.
No, indeed. I think some really, that's interesting to bring this up in a conversation that began with talking about Flash Fiction and then my mistake about 24-hour film challenge. But interestingly enough, I think in this age where everything is getting sped up, it seems, I find that more and more both literary and filmic storytellers who consistently are interesting are actually taking longer and longer to do their work. They're almost bucking the trend and saying, well, if this is the trend to get things out faster, 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 I'm going to ignore that. And I'm going to really follow my own sense of timing on this. Because that's the only way, if you're not trying to follow that wave, that's the only way is to really know that you've told the story you wanted to tell. And as I brought up on this show before, as was said to me in relation to my new film, somebody once said to me, you know, it's very easy to predict the future. You just can't know when that future is going to happen. So there is no real reason to feel like you're in a hurry about it. If it's a story you want to tell, get it right and take your time.
Absolutely right.
I'm glad we've actually got something. I feel as though it's almost been the Midweek Drive equivalent of the Singapore summit meeting there. In fact,
well, slightly different context, though, isn't it?
I could sense, actually, that Phil had made the decision within 30 seconds whether or not this was going to actually be a really successful meeting or whether he needed to have a minute and then he decided...
Well, of course I did, because Russia told me that they needed it to be a successful meeting and told me that they needed me to cancel military maneuvers and then to say that we were doing it on behalf of North Korea.
It's so good that the CIA love this show. That's all I can say. It's fantastic. We appreciate that as well. John, it's been awesome connecting with you, good sir, today. Ben, would you like to put those last two questions to John Gerald, please?
John, have you enjoyed your Tenophonic Link with us today on the show?
I have thoroughly enjoyed it.
Excellent. That's good news. And would you like to join us again sometime soon?
I would love to.
Brilliant.
And Phil now gets a 3 minute break to actually have another coffee. Shouldn't have the caffeine. and a variety of things with something I've been waiting to play actually since he took up position in the White House, a matter of over a year ago.
To Bombay, a travelling circus came. They brought an intelligent elephant, and Nelly was her name. One dark night, she slipped her iron chain. And off she ran to Hindustan and was never seen again. Rather the elephant packed the trunk and said goodbye to the circus. Off she ran with a chompity chomp, 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 chomp. Now rather the elephant packed the trunk and tumbled up the jungle. Off she ran with a chompity chomp, 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 chomp. Night by night, she danced to the circus band. When Nelly was leading the big parade, she looked so proud and grand. No more tricks for Nelly to perform. They taught her how to take a bow, and she took the crowd by storm.
I gather, Shaylee, that's what you actually got your CPR, your cardiac
training. I mean, maybe not quite that fast because you will break ribs. Mm. But yeah, I recently did a course in emergency first aid in the workplace at my new job. Mm. And the guy who was teaching it was quite funny and said that if you sing Nelly the Elephant whilst doing your compressions.
Oh, she went with a trumpety like, trump. Or trump, like, trump, trump.
Yes.
Staying alive. It is that Trump, Trump, Trump that clearly the toy dolls had kind of predicted the future of global geopolitics.
What is he doing to our world? Seriously? Who did this to America? Own up. Phil, who did you vote for?
Oh, my God. Come on now. I've always actually taken the contrary view in America that maybe politics needs fewer billionaires running for office and not more.
Radical.
Boy, I don't know how I leapt into this, but the conspiracy theory du jour relating, and I don't know how popular this gentleman was on your fair shores, but this really rocked America hard. The suicide of Anthony Bourdain.
Oh, this, yeah. He was only 61, and it was suicide, wasn't it?
Yes, and he'd had a lifelong battle with heroin, but the conspiracy theory du jour, and of course, there's always conspiracy theories surrounding any famous person's death because no famous person can ever die. First of all, and secondly, they certainly can't take their own life because they're rich and they're famous. What could go wrong? I mean, what would be not to enjoy about that lifestyle, especially if you have a lifelong heroin addiction? And so the conspiracy theory that has been put forth by none other than the king of conspiracy theories, Alex Jones, in this country, is that it wasn't a suicide. In fact, he was murdered by globalist leftists because he was about to go public with his support of Donald Trump. That's why he was murdered, because a celebrity chef was going to say that he liked Trump.
Could have been tipping point. Could have been a tipping point.
And what's interesting, though, is of all people for them to say that about was Anthony Bourdain, celebrity chef, who warned us as long ago as 2013 – even before Donald Trump had uttered the words that he was thinking of running for president, in a series of shows that Anthony Bourdain had done in Russia, where he was very critical of Vladimir Putin and Putin's regime. Indeed, everyone he interviewed on those shows has been assassinated in Russia. And he pointed out at the end of these shows, you know who Vladimir Putin reminds me of as a New Yorker? Donald Trump. He drew that connection then.
Although, thankfully, Donald Trump hasn't been known to actually ride with a topless on horseback, basically. So he hasn't quite.
Oh, well. Well, apparently, it depends on whether we've seen that tape from that hotel room.
Fair enough. I know what you say. Risky, but it's okay. It's 6:43, Siren Radio. Thank you.
Wait until Watershed.
You're saying that the CIA listens to us. I think the CIA would be rooting me on at this point. It is 60 years of the Twilight Zone. It is 50 years of the moon landing, and it's 50 years of Phil Lernis. Let's not forget.
You don't sound a day over 21.
In fact, it's almost as though the young, youthful voice that actually gave the world
Ben Lewis, probably the best reason to visit Brighton there's ever been.
Genius.
It's genius because you made me use the word Ben twice in a sentence and I pulled it off. Hey, it
deserves an Oscar, I think.
Since I've got you there and you're held captive to the hearkening to the sound of my voice, may I ask you, as an American, as a stranger to your shores, may I ask you a question that you can weigh in on about the proper use of terminology when it comes to the use of the word British? Today at our illustrious Los Angeles Breakfast Club, Lily Holloman was inducting into our club the wonderful filmmaker Christopher Monger, who directed The Englishman Who Went Up a Hill but Came Down a Mountain. And what was the other one, Lil? Temple Grandin. But she referenced him as being our new British member, and he corrected her in no uncertain terms and said he was Welsh. But I thought, and here's my understanding, and you can tell me where I'm wrong, because obviously I want to get these right. People deserve to be called what they want to be called. I knew that if he was called English, that would be a mistake. Mm-hmm. But I thought that British referred to anyone from the Isle of Great Britain. Is that not the case?
It's anybody in Wales, Scotland, and England, but some people prefer to be Welsh,
and ironically, because
English.
In terms of using and employing the term Welsh, he's actually using a word which actually means, from the ancient Saxon, slave, because obviously the Celts, the Welsh, were the slaves to the Romans. So maybe what you've actually got there is a character who's actually got some issues relating to, you know...
He has no name, he is Welsh.
Exactly.
Although I do... I've recognised over the last few years a current pattern in America where they tend to refer to accents.
When we say they, of course.
I mean
it's a big country.
As a general theme. Mm-hmm. I've noticed a lot of people in America refer to accents in the UK as the British accent as opposed to their regional accent. Mm.
Because
there's so many. Obviously, there's so many accents, and
as many accents in Britain as there are in New York City.
You know, and typically they probably all expect everyone to have received pronunciation type accents,
like the BBC news people.
That's it. People, you know,
who talk like they have marbles in their mouth.
Well, that's changed now. To be fair, I mean, that's
no, it has
well,
changed.
But
part of the important thing of making America great again is that if you show interest in other countries, you do lose your citizenship. So that's part of the problem here.
He sees it as radicalization, so don't be interested.
But we are a country that even, going back to the 1980s, I remember, you know, we always do these tests. I don't know if they have them there, but they were wonderfully informative and illustrative. But there would always be tests that would show what the average American does not know. And even back in the 1980s, one in every three Americans could not find the United States on a globe. And interestingly enough, half of them flew for Delta Airlines. But that part's a joke. But we're not so aware geographically. In fact, it took me decades to get my own parents to stop referring to Asia as the Orient, for example. And finally, it took me pointing out the Orient Express. There's a reason it doesn't go to Beijing. That what they would always refer to at the Orient was Asia, and that what they called the Middle East was what actually was considered the Orient. And I don't know why that is, but it is part of the makeup of America. And I think it dates back probably to our sense of isolationism, you know, our fervent early 20th century sense of isolationism. We want to leave the conflicts and the wars of the rest of the world behind. And because we were separated by these oceans for a while, we thought we could do that. And so it must have influenced to a degree the way that we were educated.
In 24 hours from now, Phil, the result of the first FIFA World Cup match will be known between, of course, Russia and Saudi Arabia. Tragically, for the first time since, I believe, 1994, no United States of America representation there. So USA, USA, USA will not be heard in any of the Russian stadia that are actually hosting the FIFA World Cup. Does that take away somewhat from your passion for the round ball game as a Crystal Palace supporter, Phil Leonis, or will you be inevitably rooting for Australia, given, of course, the connection with...
And now I don't even know what the heck to call them. I root for the English. I root for England.
You root for the English.
Those peoples in that island.
I don't want to get it. Well, no, because England has their own team, but also Scotland has their own
absolutely.
Team.
Absolutely.
Right? Wales, Northern Ireland, and Republic of Ireland.
But they didn't qualify.
Okay.
None of them qualified.
Scotland definitely didn't qualify.
But no, I actually always root for England. I mean, I do want the U.S. to have a good showing, but this will tell you something. this is news to me that the World Cup is starting. I did not even know that, which lets you know how much coverage it's getting here in the States.
But the good news on top of that is...
But I would say this. If Russia does not win, it's because the system is rigged. Russia has to win, and Russia has to be allowed back into the G7, even though they're not one of the seven or eight biggest economies. It has to happen.
In 8 years from now, in 2026, the World Cup is in America, Mexico, and Canada, as revealed today. You have got the World Cup for 2026.
The Americas.
The Americas, as opposed
to Canada.
Hopefully they won't build the wall, because that's going to create problems, won't it, really? Because, I mean, it's sharing the actual match between Mexico and America, you know, USA, United States,
well,
America, and so
how are they going to get a game in Alaska? Is there going to be... that included?
Well, either way,
Hawaii?
Morocco sadly have lost out, but never mind. So that's something to look forward to in times to come. After Qatar in 2022, in 2026... The great ball game, the sacred routine that started in China and in Aztec Brazil and was given rules and form by the public schools of England in the 19th century, will be coming to your continent, Phil.
Well, there are no parties like World Cup parties when you're a host country. And I learned this when I was on location directing my first film in 1994 in the San Francisco Bay Area. And the San Francisco Bay Area was host to the World Cup. And I was fortunate enough to get to attend several parties with the Brazilian delegation in Los Gatos, California. There have never been parties like that, as far as I know.
And in fact, actually, I've just decided to make Phil an honorary commentator on the World Cup and a predictor for this routine. I'm going to give you a few matches from England's group, which is Group G, Phil. And it's going to be up to you to actually come up with the correct prediction. And we'll know the results by this time next week. So just two matches. Belgium versus Panama. Belgium versus Panama. Where do you want to go? What's your prediction for that?
I have to make the prediction now. I can't do it on the morning edition.
No. Well, actually, I suppose technically we could hold off if
he needs to do some research.
Exactly. So, because that's what
I mean. I'm so torn because I love both waffles and canals, and I'm torn at this moment.
Well, the next one, Tunisia versus England, and if it helps, that's being played in the Volgograd Arena on Monday.
Well, I'm thinking that you're tipping me that I should pick England by mispronouncing Tunisia. I'm thinking that that's what you're giving me a tip. Oh. Phil, don't go to the mispronounced country. England's the favorite to win. Look, this is the point that I would have to pick England because, as you know, with my annual Oscar battle with Richard Fitzwilliams, there are certain categories where whether I think they will win or not, I have to pick the one that I have a strong rooting interest for, because there's nothing worse than predicting against the team you want to have win. The conflict that builds within you, it's migraine inducing. I would have to have, there's not enough coffee in the world to stave off that.
We'd have to get a special assignment set up with Stephanie Romaszewski.
So England, I will go for. And you know what? I'm going to say Belgium. I'm going nuts on this.
Wild card, Belgium.
And yeah. do you want to predict a score for both? Bonus points if you predict a score.
Yes. I do believe that eventually someone will score in those games. Yes.
Good prediction. I like it.
This
is going to go wrong if it's 0-0.
A score. I have predicted that. Yeah. I mean, it seems like there's plenty of those, the 0-0. The 0-0. You mean?
Precisely.
Yeah. Are we expecting any upsets, though, Phil? Is that something we're expecting? World Cup upsets?
Don't go down.
Yes, if my predictions are wrong, you can expect me to be upset. Yes.
As was once said in the days of the high spots of New York Cosmos, when indeed they avoided any chance of a 0-0 draw in the States by actually having shootouts, a 0-0 draw is a bit like kissing your sister. It's just a quote at the time.
Different type of shootout. America,
different time, different era.
What do you have against my sister? I don't understand.
The morning, the Midweek Drive Morning Edition will be launched. Phil, will you be with us tomorrow morning?
Yes, I will. And again, because I've had coffee, and this is the thing about being cornered last week about my sleep pattern and about my use of coffee. If you really want me to have a regular, healthy sleep pattern, it means you will never hear from me on the morning edition.
Oh, well, in which case, I'll have a word with Stephanie, and when she's knocked off, we'll coordinate that. Gabriella Peralta should be joining us. Richard Fitzwilliams will be talking about his views. You've seen the photograph, presumably, of Donald Trump and the G7 team and the Caravaggio impact that he put together on that sort of basis. He'll be talking about Jurassic World as well. Ooh. Great movie. Very good. I'd give it 9.5 out of 10. Thought that he did very well. Up to the standard of Solo and others as well. So that's Richard tomorrow morning. Ben, last two questions, please. Let's reverse it, because Phil, it's Ben's first live 2-hour show for a year. Has it been a year? More or less.
Almost a year.
Well, 10 months. Yeah, 10 months. He's off next week to do another placement, so we won't actually see him again in the studio. He'll be around tomorrow morning, I think.
I'll be in tomorrow morning.
Once every 10 months, whether they need you or not, is really...
That's it. It's all about the average.
Exactly. Has it been good for you, Ben?
It's been very enjoyable, thank you.
Phil, have you enjoyed the programme, which has taken us through a whole range of things? Some I hadn't even anticipated going into, but there we are.
Yeah, no, I had a great time, and I was going to hold off before Skyping in, because I was enjoying the segment with John so much about publishing, but then I just had some questions I wanted to ask. So thank you for letting me join you early.
As I said, Phil, it's like the Adam West Batman scenario, the connection between Commissioner Gordon and Wayne Manor. The red hot line for the Leonis line, as we refer to it, is always there. You know, you just dial up. We haven't as yet got a chap to come along and say, hey, I'm getting him in a few moments, sir, because the butler is kind of just not around, but you know, it's a different sort of line, etc. Mm. Little roll of honour as far as the show is actually concerned. Thanks to William Coles, Malcolm Tomlinson, Anna Lewis, Kira Alsbrook, John Gerald, and Phil Leonis, and of course Phil Hamlin-Williams. Remember that Flash Fictions competition is available, and you can do all sorts of magical things with that as well. Lincoln Book Festival coming up too. We'll be probably squeezing in the Father's Day feature tomorrow. Back today. Thanks to Shaylee. Enjoyed it, Shaylee?
Oh, I have indeed, as always.
So last week, of course, I did clip it, but we had a fantastic sung entry of Happy Trails by Chloe Rose, who kind of astounded us all with a wonderful sort of rendition of those.
Is
last
this
two
Miss
words.
Lincolnshire for 2018?
Yes, it is, actually. Yes. Joining us next week at the Lincolnshire Show. It is Lincolnshire Show Day. What would you like us to say this week, Phil? What's the exit routine? Is it a case of don't forget Chilpack Hollywood? It's an extra special, almost hour and a half, part one of the best comedy movies ever, and yet no sign as yet of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Shocked.
Oh, yeah, spoiler alert, that's not going to get mentioned. Maybe I'll bring that up if we do a part three.
Well,
it is interesting, the comedy movies that do not get mentioned at all, and I'm keeping a list of them, and I will put that on there. That's worthy of actually discussing in a follow-up. I don't know. I'm kind of in the mood for a live long and prosper.
Yeah, I think so. I think
nice.
So. Okay, right. So a one, a two, and three.
Live long and prosper.
You know what love is, so please don't stop it.